I am joined in studio, and I have to say I'm very, very excited about this, by Dr. Ruth Brennan. You're very, very welcome to Near FM.
Thank you very much, Sabrina.
So, Ruth, you are from the Centre for Environmental Humanities in Trinity College Dublin, which is quite a mouthful. So tell us a little bit, just briefly, about what is the Centre for Environmental Humanities?
So the Trinity Centre for Environmental Humanities is an interdisciplinary research centre that was set up a few years ago, led by Professor Paul Holm, who's an environmental historian. It sits within the School of Histories and Humanities in Trinity. But as I said, it's interdisciplinary, so we don't just have historians there. So we do have quite a few environmental historians. We have people that work in the digital humanities. We have a marine ecologist there, and myself, I'm a marine social scientist. And we work very much at the policy interface. So we try to give a higher profile to the importance of the arts, humanities and social sciences in policy, and to bring that to policymakers, and to show what contributions the arts, humanities and social sciences can make within the policy environment.
Fantastic. So a marine social scientist.
Marine social scientist, yes.
And this is going to sound like a really bizarre question, but like, if we go back to when you were a little girl, mm-hmm. what did you want to be? Was that something that you envisaged for your future, or,
No, never. I think when I was a little girl, I wanted to be a teacher. And ironically, now that I'm working as an academic, I do some teaching, but that wasn't what I had in mind at all. I kind of fell into becoming a marine social scientist without realising it, because when I finished school, I actually studied law and I worked as a solicitor for several years.
Wow, I did not know that.
Really?
Yeah. just for our listeners, myself and Ruth have known each other now for probably about a year and a half or so, and we actually live about 30 seconds from each other, so it's actually a really nice opportunity to actually kind of get to know a slightly different side to you.
Yeah.
So you worked as a solicitor for 7 years?
I worked as a solicitor for 5 years.
5 years.
I worked in London, in Paris and in Dublin as a solicitor. I left law twice. The first time I left, I went travelling for what I thought was going to be 1 year, but it was actually 2 years. I was travelling and working. And at the end of my first year travelling, I was already trained as a diver, but I trained as a dive master, which means that I could guide people underwater. And then I decided to travel and work as a dive master for the second year. And that really brought me into the space of the marine environment, where I was discovering this completely different world that I had no idea about. And I was really discovering it in a very experiential way, because every morning I would get up, I would lead the boat full of divers. And as I was explaining to them this amazing world that we have beneath the water, I was learning myself and getting more and more connected with that. So I was working in Latin America, in Central America. I was working as a dive master in Honduras. I worked for a little bit in Nicaragua in a hostel rather than in diving. And then I worked in Guatemala and Belize on a boat, where we would take people out from Guatemala and go diving around the Zapatilla Keys in Belize. So after I came back from those 2 years of quite a contrast to my life as a lawyer beforehand, I had this clue in my head that I knew I wanted to do something with the marine environment, but I didn't know what it was. And I actually ended up going back to being a lawyer for a year in Dublin while I figured it out. So when I left, I still didn't know exactly what it was. The only clue that I had was I want to do some work with the marine environment, and I don't want to be a dive master for the rest of my life. So I left my job for the second time. This time I obviously told my employers, but I didn't tell my family because I didn't have a plan and I didn't know what I was going to do. So everyone thought I was still a solicitor, and I was sitting at home going, okay, what's my next step? So I Googled marine volunteering, and I ended up finding the Irish Seal Sanctuary, who were looking for animal handlers.
Wow.
So I thought, okay, I'll go out there and I'll do a bit of volunteering. It's in the context of the marine environment. And that really led me into the policy environment, because they were working with fishing communities, and they made me become very aware of the impact of legislation at, say, a national or a European level on fishing communities, particularly small-scale fishing communities, and how that can often impact disproportionately on small-scale fishing communities, for example, in relation to conservation and management of the marine environment. And I started to see how my skills as a lawyer could translate into that environment.
So you're bringing the two worlds of, like, the two worlds of experience that you have together to have an impact on and making, hopefully making some kind of life better?
Well, I didn't actually have a way to do it at the time because I didn't have the qualifications. So I still had this CV that was like full of legal qualifications, but nothing to, because I thought, well, do I need to go back and like do a degree in marine science? I'd already spent so long studying that I didn't particularly want to do that. But then I found a master's in Plymouth University, which was open to law, sociology and economics graduates. And it would give you an MSc, a master's in science, after 1 year, and it was in marine policy, so it was coastal and ocean policy.
It's like it was made for you.
It was like it was made for me. So I applied for that, and I did that a year, and that course, that master's course, had been designed and run by a professor called Professor Lawrence Mee. And he had started out as a natural scientist, he had started out as a chemist, then he moved into social science, and he also worked for 12 years in the UN. And he noticed that there was a real need for people who could move between the different worlds, that could move between the world of science, social science, policymakers, and speak these different languages and almost kind of work as translators of kind of different languages in these different worlds. So he designed this Marine Policy Masters to actually train people to be able to understand the world of policy, which operates at a very different rhythm to the world of, say, small-scale communities, coastal communities, and also to academia. And so that was the training that I got there. And then after that, he actually took over as the director of a research centre in Scotland, on the west coast of Scotland, called SAMS, the Scottish Association for Marine Science. At the time, and SAMS is a very old research centre, it was set up in the late 1800s, it was the late 1800s. So when I went there, there was only one social scientist, and Professor Lawrence Mee really had a vision that he wanted to build the social science team in SAMS, so I became the second social scientist there.
Wow.
I was there for 7 years until 2015. So that's kind of how, and I did my, I had a master's at that stage, and I was working full time at SAMS, but I also did a PhD part time over 6 years. And that PhD was in marine social science, except it wasn't called marine social science at the time because nobody really knew what marine social science was. Because marine social science is, I call it an interdiscipline because it draws from so many different disciplines. And usually when I say marine social scientist to people, they actually hear marine science or marine biologist.
Yes.
So
They're missing out the social part of that.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. So what I do is I look at the relationships between people and the marine environment. So when I was working in Scotland, I was in a mainly natural science marine environment. There were about 100 natural scientists there. So I was working very closely with ecologists, with oceanographers, with biogeochemists, with all these people coming to marine science from different angles within the natural sciences. And then I was sitting there as a social scientist. It's only since last September, actually, that the first Marine Social Science Network has been launched. It was launched from the UK.
So I'm getting the impression that there's a certain kind of newness to marine social biology. Or so marine social science, sorry.
Marine social science,
and
yeah.
That it's something that's kind of developing. It's something that's quite new.
Yeah, so it's something that's emerging. I think it has been there for a while, but there hasn't actually been a name for it. Because if you look at people who identify as marine social scientists, they can be coming from a variety of different backgrounds. And in my case, I look at and I'm very interested in how the marine environment is governed, how it is managed, but I also work on the ground very, very closely with small-scale coastal communities, and I'm really interested in understanding the social, the cultural, the historical contexts of those communities, the heritage that is there, and their connections with their environment, the connections between humans and nature more broadly. Because often what we see in the policy environment is that you have the natural, the social and the economic that are treated as very, very separate areas. And it's much more complex to think about humans and nature as intertwined. But when we think about people in fishing communities, for example, fishermen out in boats, the very way that they carry on their day-to-day work, their very being, means that they are intertwined with the sea,
yes.
With the ocean. So they don't necessarily see themselves or feel themselves as separate from that. So then when you have, say, legislation or policies that are being made, which appears, and they may have very, very good purposes, which appears to kind of separate that out, then that doesn't always make sense to people who live their environment in a very kind of embodied way.
It is. It's a slightly different rhythm. It's a slightly different movement that they have. And I mean, I come from West Clare, and there are, you know, fishing communities in kind of, probably if you go back to like Carrigaholt, Kilbaha, down towards Loophead, the very, very tip, like the nose of Clare, I suppose. And, you know, when I was, one of the things that actually is really, really part of the culture and the community down there is the Curragh building, which is really quite specific to that area. And it's something that, like, even now, like, I didn't grow up in a fishing community. We were close to the sea, but not that close either. But when I see pictures now of Curraghs, and you see them every once in a while, you'll walk into a random bar in the city centre, and there'll be a painting up on a wall in the corner, and there's this really iconic image that is really iconic for me. I don't know if it's for everybody else. It's three fishermen carrying a Curragh over their head, walking in from Scattery Island off the coast of Kilrush, and it's just part of that culture. And that culture of, because that's an economic activity that is intertwined into art, and you know, people now have a sense of belonging to that, and there's a sense of recognition with that. So am I kind of getting the right idea?
No, exactly. Yes, it's and that's what, as a marine social scientist, that's what I tend to do and to think about. It's very much thinking about relationships between different things, rather than trying to, and as a marine social scientist as well, I'm a qualitative marine social scientist rather than a quantitative scientist. So I don't measure things in numbers. So, for example, if there is a conflict going on, it was funny, when I was working in Scotland, when I was working on a conflict around a marine protected area, the natural scientists in the lab would ask me, okay, so how many people are for and how many people are against?
Yeah, okay.
And I'd say, well, I can't answer that question because that's not a question that I'm asking. So I can't tell you how many people are for and how many people are against and present that in a pie chart, but I will be able to give you the stories that are going on behind the conflict. I might be able to give you some indication about how the history or the social setting has maybe contributed to shaping people's behaviours and reactions towards what they perceive as legislation or policies, which doesn't quite fit the way that they relate to their environment. So it's very much the rich and the small detail that I will look at. But at the same time, because I work at the interface of that world and the policy environment, I'm also thinking at a higher level to see how that actually kind of interfaces or comes together, and what happens in that area where they meet, if they do meet. Because one of the other things that I think about very much is power relationships. So whose are the voices that are being heard over particular issues? Whose voices are not being heard? Whose stories are being told? Whose stories are not being told? And why is this?
And there is a power dynamic there. And power dynamics are something which are really quite fascinating to look into, and how they can actually control a situation. So there's a whole lot of things going on there. And that, I think it's really interesting what you mentioned earlier on about the language being used, because the language of policymakers and the language of legislation and the language of fishermen are three different languages. And, you know, the legislation and the policymakers, that language is kind of similar, but the fishermen will speak a completely different lingo. And there's a whole life and a whole kind of dialect around how they operate. And it's very hard for these people to understand each other. So you need somebody that can kind of operate in that sphere between them. Now, Ruth, tell me about Co-Sustain.
So Co-Sustain is a new project that I started to work on in October. So it's funded by the European Commission. It's a Marie Curie individual fellowship, which means that for 2 years I'm going to be funded to work on this project until October 2020. And the project is basically looking at small-scale fisheries in the Irish Islands. So I'm looking at four island groups, the Donegal Islands, the Mayo Islands, the Galway Islands and the Cork Islands. And I'm going to be working very closely with an organisation called IMRO, the Irish Islands Marine Resource Organisation there, and looking at how we can co-design, design together ways of managing small-scale fisheries, the marine environment, in ways that meets the needs of those coastal communities, all of which are likely to have very different priorities, and also meets conservation and management objectives at national, European and an international level. So, as I said, it's a 2-year project, and it's going to be working particularly with the island fishing communities, not just fishermen, because often when we think about fishing, we think of fishermen in boats. But of course, the fishing industry, fishing is far broader than that, because fishing, the men in boats who go out fishing would not be able to do that without a whole lot of support behind them, which very often includes women, fishing families. I was talking to some fishermen just before Christmas, and I remember asking them what they thought the role of women in the fishing industry was, because it's something that researchers have been writing about this for years, but it's not necessarily something that we necessarily hear about in the discourse when we're talking about fishermen. And when I asked the question, they immediately said something like, oh, she keeps the show on the road, she's the backbone, she does the VAT returns, she sources parts for the boats, she picks up the crew and brings them to the boats, she puts up having people coming in and out of her house all the time. Basically, without that...
she's an operations manager.
Absolutely.
That's fascinating, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Because we do have that traditional view, and I mean, I'm guilty of that myself, where I think, you know, it's a man with, you know, possibly a yellow plastic hat on. I don't know why I've picked a yellow plastic hat on, with boots up to kind of his mid-thigh going out. And, you know, it's this idea that I have, and it's, you know, you kind of forget that there's a whole family behind that. There's, you know, behind every great man there's a great woman, as they say, you know.
And you do also have women who are fishers as well.
And that was the next question I was going to ask you.
Who are skippers. So the large majority would be men, but you do have fishers, have women who are fishers. And I think it was a couple of years ago that there was a conference in Dublin about women in the maritime industry, and you had women who were represented in the maritime industry, not just in fishing, but in a whole range of areas. And that was very, very interesting to see who those speakers were. Because again, it's not something that we necessarily hear about or are aware of.
That's absolutely fascinating. Mm-hmm. Now, you're going to be working with Donegal, Mayo, Galway and Cork. So I know you're kind of at the start of this two-year process. So have you started to engage with the communities already?
Yes, I'm literally just at the start of that. So usually my research approach is kind of very open and flexible at the start. This is a participatory research project, as all my research is, which means that I try to design and lead the projects very much in coordination and in partnership with the people that I am working with in the local communities. So at the start of a research project, rather than going in armed with a list of pre-designed questions, I go in to listen. So it's quite a slow process at the start, because I want to hear what the stories are, what people's burning issues are, what the stories are that they have to tell me. And as I said, I'm expecting that they will be quite different on the islands. Different things are going to have different priorities. So, for example, some islands will be located much further away from the mainland than others. So transport might be a bigger issue on other islands in terms of accessing markets for fish and things like that. Some islands will have more tourism than others. So on the islands that don't have tourism, there might be, for example, more depopulation going on, but generally declining populations are kind of an issue across the board on the islands. So I listen to people's stories, and then from there I try to focus my research and also listening to policymakers, because I do talk to people in the policy environment as well, and I will be doing that. And I will try to focus my research in a way that that the findings that will come out of that research will be useful and will make sense to the people that I'm working with and the policy environment.
That's really, really
that's
exciting. So what kind of outcomes are you hoping to get? Now, I know that it's you're really, really at the start of this.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to kind of look down the gauntlet of 2 years and see. Like, but where do you want to be in 2020?
So I want to have an understanding of I want to have an understanding of the kinds of stories or narratives that people are telling themselves or talking about on the different islands, and to think about which of these stories are actually leading them towards viable and sustainable futures, and which are hindering that movement towards viable and sustainable futures. So that's one outcome. That I want to understand. So that's constantly in my mind. What are the stories that I'm hearing? What are the different stories that I'm hearing, and where are they leading to, and where might they have come from? I also want to look at the role of women in, as I was talking about, in the small scale fishing industry, and to bring some of their voices into this research, so that I'm not going to be just talking to fishermen in the different communities. We're really trying to understand kind of the broader and the richer picture of the fishing communities in general, including women's voices.
That's brilliant. Now, I've got a slightly, and I hope it's not a tricky question. The fishing industry in Ireland and its relationship to the EU is a little bit strained, I imagine. This is my perception of it.
Yeah.
And this is a European project. And, you know, what kind of an impact has the EU had on, or is that something that you've kind of had a chance to examine or look at, the impact that the EU and some of the policies that have come down from a European level that have had on fishing communities?
No, it's a huge question.
It is a huge question.
Yeah.
And I've really thrown that out there at you, kind of out of nowhere.
It depends. It would depend on fishing communities, because we can't talk about fishing communities as all being the same. I mean, I mentioned small-scale fishing communities at the start, and when I'm talking about small-scale fishing, the EU has a general definition of small-scale fishing, which is boats that are under 12 metres and that are using non-towed gear. So by non-towed gear, you're talking about, say, pots that are catching crabs and lobsters, or you're talking about nets that you can throw out, or you're talking about line fishing. So for example, depending on the kind of fishing that you're doing, EU policies might have a very, very different impact on you, depending on, because generally the people who are contributing in larger numbers to the economy tend to have more weight and more power and more voices at the decision-making table.
Yes.
And while our small-scale fishers make up the vast majority of the Irish fishing fleet, in terms of the economics, it's a lower percentage that they obviously bring in, because it's much, much smaller.
Okay.
Value and volume of fishing that they're actually.
But there'd actually be more people operating.
Yeah.
And more small businesses.
Yes, and smaller boats. But in terms of EU policy, so I also actually sit in the European Parliament every month on the PESH Committee, on the Fisheries Committee, and I'm a local advisor to the MEP Luke Ming Flanagan. And I've been doing that since last May. And that's been very, very interesting to hear on a month-to-month basis the issues that the MEPs are talking about. And there is a lot of debate around small-scale fisheries, not just in Ireland, but obviously around Europe. You have a platform in the EU called LIFE, Low Impact Fishers Europe, which IMRO are a member of, the Irish Isles Marine Resource Organisation, that I'm working with, they're a member of the Low Impact Fishers of Europe, and they are trying to give a platform to the voices of small scale fishers at a European level. And to promote the visibility of small-scale fishers at a European level. And for example, in the main policy instrument at the European level, which is regulating fisheries, is the Common Fisheries Policy. And the Common Fisheries Policy is reviewed every few years and it's reformed. And in the last, in the 2014 Common Fisheries Policy, it actually specifically refers to the islands which are dependent on small-scale fisheries and talks about how it's important for governments to take this into account when they're managing their fisheries. By the very fact that we have organisations like Low Impact Fishers of Europe that have organised at a European level, that indicates that the voices of small-scale fishers at a European level have often felt invisible or unheard and left behind. But particularly with the importance of sustainability in the marine environment, there is an awful lot more attention now being given to small-scale fishers and the importance of small-scale fishers, and a recognition of the fact that they're that the economics is not just what's important, but they're very, very important for the social and cultural fabric of communities as well.
It's so complex and intertwined, and it's really interesting to see all of these things come together. And it's because life is not just like, this is box A and this is box B and this is box C. That's not how any community or any sector work at all. Like, there's so many things that it has an impact on. Now, this week has been exciting because you have launched the website, which is...
So the website is called Belonging to the Sea. So you can find it at belongingtothesea.com. And there's also a Twitter account, which is at Belonging to Sea.
Fantastic. Now, tell me a little bit about why Belonging to Sea.
So I chose the name Belonging to the Sea, as I was saying to you earlier, because I wanted the website to be a little bit more findable or searchable or accessible, rather than calling it Co-Sustain after the name of the project, which was, and the name Co-Sustain was chosen because, as I was saying earlier, when you apply for an EU grant, you have to choose an acronym to name that EU grant. And all the acronyms I was looking for, which would have been more fishy, had already been taken.
What was the one that you really, really wanted?
Oh, I can't remember what it was, but there were lots with fish in there.
They were all gone.
So Co-Sustain was collaborative sustainable innovation, which was about collaborating to come up with innovative approaches to manage and govern the fishing industry. But the reason that I chose Belonging to the Sea, two reasons really. One, I wanted to really highlight upfront that relationship, that connection that fishing communities have with their environment, that real sense of belonging. And in Irish it's called, and it's a difficult to translate word, the word, it's captured by the word duchas or duchas namara in Irish. And the other reason that I wanted to call the website Belonging to the Sea was that in 2012, when I was mainly working in Scotland, I also did some research on Arranmore Island in Donegal. And at the time I was working with a visual artist and filmmaker from Glasgow and also with another marine social scientist who was from the Island of Skye in Scotland. And one of the first pieces of work that I did as an art science collaboration was looking at the conflict on the island of Barra in the Outer Hebrides around the creation of a marine protected area, and also looking at the conflict on Arranmore, which was around the ban on drift net fishing for salmon, which dated back to 2006. So we wanted to look at those two conflicts and to write about what had happened there, not in a sense of who was right or who was wrong, but to give more of a rich picture of the actual social, cultural, historical context that those conflicts were sitting in. And so what we were doing on both of the islands was talking to the fishing communities, mainly to the fishermen, about the stories that were in the sea around them, as well as the biological diversity. There was a huge cultural diversity that was there. So the fishermen could point to rocks, could point to reefs, and could tell you names that have been there sometimes for generations, sometimes quite new names, and stories that were associated with them. And that work found its way into a publication called, it was in three languages. It was in English, translated into Irish and into Scottish Gaelic. So it's called Duchas na Mara in Irish and in Scottish Gaelic.
Oh, wow.
Spelled slightly differently, but the same Duchas na Mara, and which we translated loosely as belonging to the sea. And you can find that online as well on the website mappingthesea.net, which is where all my art science work is. So I wanted, because that was the first piece of work that I did on Aran Mór, and now I'm back working with the islands, including the Donegal Islands and Aran Mór, I wanted the name to link back to that piece of work that I did. And as I said, to highlight the connection, the very, very strong connection that coastal communities have with their environment, particularly the marine environment.
Ruth, that's absolutely fantastic. I feel like this is a topic that I would have never known anything about. And it's like, it's a topic that I would never have known anything about. But I also, I don't think it's something that I would have organically gone to look for. But I absolutely love to hear somebody talking about something they're so passionate about and that they love so much, because I think it's, you could listen to somebody talk about something they're passionate about for hours and hours and hours, and I could genuinely listen to you talk about it for hours because I can feel the passion that you have for it coming through, and it's really, really exciting, and it's really, really, it's such an interesting project. And for the next 2 years you are probably going to be quite unsettled in life, I suppose. Do you envisage quite a lot of movement and travelling? And
So IMRO, the Irish Islands Marine Resources Organisation, is a network, so it's not situated in any one particular place. So usually what I would do with fieldwork is I would go and stay in a particular place for like maybe a month or two at a time. But here I'm dealing with quite a whole range of islands across the four island groups. So I'm going to be visiting different islands. As I said, I have already visited some islands in the Donegal and the Galway Islands, particularly in the next couple of months when the weather is still not great, when fishermen might be out of the water. I'm hoping to kind of do initial visits, just listening to people there, both people who are representatives of IMRO in the islands and also generally to the fishing communities there. And what I'm trying to do is to kind of align myself with different events that I'm trying to find out about, events that are going on in the islands or meetings that are going on, so that I can turn up at the same time that people are already there. Because I'm very conscious of the fact, as a researcher, that I'm funded, I'm paid to do this research. The people who talk to me, who give me interviews, who give me their time, are very often not paid for that.
Yep.
So particularly with fishermen, I mean, if they're out of the water and they're already at a meeting and they've already dedicated their time to that, it makes sense to me to align with that and to be able to have some of their time there rather than asking them to spend time with me specifically just to talk to me.
So Ruth, just very quickly before we finish up, tell me again, where can people find out more information about this and to kind of keep following it?
So you can follow it on Twitter. So the Twitter handle is at Belonging to Sea, and the website is www.belongingtothesea.com. And also what I'll be doing is, after every time I do a field trip, I'll be writing a short blog about it. And that's both to help me to record my responses to the field, particularly initially, but also I'll be writing about it in a way that's not necessarily as academic as the way that I would write about it if I want to publish it in an academic journal. So hopefully it'll be a blog that will make it more accessible to the general public, which is also very, very important for research which is publicly funded, that people can actually access the research, that they can read about it, that they can understand it, and they know where to find it.